Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Today on the show, during the partial government shutdown, the oil and gas industry says it's feeling the impact.
We're paying a price for it, and no business likes being told you can't operate.
But critics say the industry is still getting a better deal than most.
The legislature's back in session, and it's considering changing the way it raises taxes.
The object is not to raise more revenue. The object is to stabilize revenue.
And we'll look at how the gender wage gap extends to some of Wyoming's pro skiers.
You know, the men and the women, they're skiing the same terrain. So that's really important that we provide the same payout to the men and the women.
Those stories and our latest I Respectfully Disagree is coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. One industry that's been a key supporter of President Trump is no fan of the federal shutdown. Oil and gas drilling is booming in Wyoming. But the majority of that is on federal lands, and operators worry about the impact. While critics argue, they're still getting a better deal than most. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
Tom Midas heads a small oil and gas company in Casper, and he's planning a new project. He's begun the lengthy process with the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, to find new parcels for development, but has had to put that on hold.
With the BLM shut down, the studies on parcels that we've nominated are not happening.
Midas is still hoping to buy that land this year, but now he's not sure when it will happen. BLM is responsible for that environmental review, but most employees are on furlough.
The longer the shutdown goes on, the longer we all will be unable to go ahead with the work we want to do.
Midas says there's enough uncertainty trying to predict when the price of oil will be right. He says this shutdown is really hard for a small company like his.
We're paying a price for it, and no business likes being told you can't operate.
The oil and gas industry has been doing well in recent years for lots of reasons, including the Trump administration's push to open up vast areas of public land for drilling and to speed up the permitting process, plus better technology and cheap land. Kathleen Scama is with the Western Energy Alliance, a group of oil and gas companies. She says if the shutdown goes on much longer, it threatens to slow all that down, and not just in Wyoming.
Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, same kind of situation.
There's also a lot of confusion. The BLM says it is still processing online applications to drill. That's prompted criticism that the Trump administration is favoring the energy industry. But Scama says the limited staff and confusion could limit the application processing past 2013 numbers. A report found the government shutdown back then wasn't able to process 200 applications to start drilling.
Companies are waiting for leases. If you don't have your full lease hold, it's hard to do the exploratory work or the full development work that you're planning on, and it just causes your development to slip.
But a Petroleum Association of Wyoming memo obtained secondhand shows permits aren't just being processed. It's activities associated with it. Four Wyoming field offices plan to start doing that work Monday, January 14th. The memo also says environmental and archaeological reviews are not happening during the shutdown. The budget lasts for up to 2 months, accounting for a limited number of people. Amy Snover says it's disappointing the Interior Department is prioritizing oil and gas over the many other areas in need of resources. Snover leads the Northwest Climate Adaptation Science Center, one of eight federal academic partnered facilities focusing on finding solutions to climate change.
It's a surprising choice of what is considered bare minimum essentials and what people decide to put their resources towards.
Nita Culver of the Wilderness Society agrees and adds she's concerned about places where drilling is already happening. She worries about a lack of oversight. There's a spill or a leak from a well pad. BLM's shutdown plan says there are essential employees on the ground for inspection, enforcement, and emergency response. But
I would definitely worry that that is something right now with the shutdown that BLM is not paying any more attention to than it ever does and would probably be paying less attention to than it does. You know, workers are not being paid. There's nobody to supervise. And certainly there's not a lot of incentive or ability to get out and about right now.
Meanwhile, there's another round of oil and gas lease sales in February and March. Some in the industry worry that if the shutdown drags on, that won't happen. But environmental advocates say an uninterrupted lease sale could mean work behind the scenes from the BLM during the shutdown, something they say should not be happening. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
The Wyoming legislative session kicked off this week with over 210 bills and more to come. That's a lot of proposed legislation. And since lawmakers always give priority to committee bills, most of that proposed legislation won't go anywhere. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck asked some lawmakers what the top priority is this session, and it's a familiar refrain.
If you walk the halls of the Jonah Building, where the Wyoming legislature meets, you will see lawmakers discussing hot topics related to education, healthcare, elections, and what to do about Wyoming's growing prison population. But like most years, the main focus is on money. For several years now, lawmakers have worried about unstable revenue sources. I realize that sounds like jargon, so let me explain that legislators plan their budget on the amount of money they collect from taxes. As individuals, most of us contribute very little, and the industry that contributes the most tax revenue is the energy industry. When energy is going great guns, Wyoming has money to spend or invest. When prices decline, the state is essentially screwed. The buzzword these days is stabilizing revenue. Here is Senate President Drew Perkins.
We can do that by looking for ways to broaden our tax base while lowering the tax rate. The object is not to raise more revenue. The object is to stabilize revenue.
Over the years, the legislature has allowed a lot of businesses to get a tax break. For instance, when I pay my gym membership or get a massage, I don't pay a sales tax. The new thinking is that maybe businesses outside of the energy industry should also contribute to things like roads and other services the state provides. So Perkins is calling on legislators to reform Wyoming's tax structure and have the service industry start to contribute.
The other seven or so states that do not impose income taxes tax significantly more services than the state of Wyoming does. We need to have out-of-state visitors pay a fair share of the services and the benefits that they enjoy when they come to our state.
A lot of you may be screaming at your radio, cut the budget first. The thing is, they have. Speaker of the House Steve Harshman said this week that it's time to try something new.
We've cut $400 million from our budget, and I think at some point you're not going to cut your way to prosperity. And I think we've got to be cognizant of that and how we're going to do this.
Another Casper Republican, Senator Bill Landon, laughs when he thinks about how many years people have proposed broadening the tax base. But with the worry over money the past few years, he says he's on board.
You know, you're right. We have visited that theme an awful lot during my tenure down here, and I think it's time for us to slide up to the table and go to work and see if we can't balance this thing out a little bit so that we can at least take the peaks and valleys off of that boom and bust.
Senate Minority Leader Chris Rothfuss is a huge fan of this idea. Rothfuss has wanted the state to look at taxes in the past, but he thinks this is a good first step.
I don't think we can put that off any longer, and I think there is enough momentum right now that if we can't achieve some type of legitimate revenue diversification or at least steps towards it, then I don't know what it's going to take.
Just outside the House of Representatives, fellow Democrat Andy Schwartz of Jackson, who's a member of the House Appropriations Committee, says they are talking about needing up to $200 million a year to keep the budget stable. He notes that in the last few years, Wyoming's investment income has overcome the energy downturn, but he's worried about this year.
Certainly this year, the stock market's volatility raises certain questions as to how much investment income we'll get.
Cheyenne Republican Dan Swanitzer will oversee the House Revenue Committee for the first time. All revenue bills must start in the House, and Swanitzer thinks there is a lot of momentum in his committee, and it's possible minor tax bills could also pass.
Everyone is in agreement that there is some revenue raising necessary. It's a lot of conversation going on kind of behind the scenes right now, and where everybody is personally, what they feel comfortable with, and it's fascinating.
But while he is hopeful, Senator Chris Rothfuss is far from confident. He says it's possible that newly elected lawmakers could put a halt to all of this.
We know historically that legislators make pledges. They won't support any new taxation, any new taxes. I don't know whether that's going to be extended to this concept of it's not an increase in revenue, but it's a diversification of the types of revenue.
Rothfuss is interested to see what Republican leaders who like this idea are able to do to put together enough votes, but he adds that he doesn't think the Senate has those votes yet. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
When we come back, Wyoming's members of Congress tell us their goals and our latest I Respectfully Disagree. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Every year, the Wyoming Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault gives out what they call Peace Awards. That's promoting excellence in advocacy for change and empowerment. Back in November, they gave one out for best leadership and policymaking. It went to six Wyoming lawmakers who worked to pass six new laws to better protect survivors of violence. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards takes it from here.
Tara Muir is the director of the coalition and says she nominated the six representatives because of their spirit of bipartisanship. Three were Democrats, Charles Pelkey, Kathy Connolly, Debbie Bovee, and three Republicans, Bo Bightman, Dan Kirkbride, and Eric Barlow. Muir called them the Gang of Six.
And, you know, you sit back there in what we call the fishbowl and watch, and you're just shaking your head going, this is magic. This was a magical year. All those chips just kept falling our way, and it was great to see their heart in it every day.
Muir says she saw the group come together while serving on the Joint Judiciary Committee together. One day, they heard a survivor's testimony about how hard it was to retell her painful story every year so that she could renew her protection order.
And it was that meeting. It was a cold November day, and several of the representatives just came up to this survivor afterwards and said, we're going to do all we can to make this happen. And they did.
They passed a bill, so now survivors only have to renew those protection orders every 3 years. I spoke with the two members of the gang, perhaps most on the opposite ends of the political spectrum, Charles Pelkey and Bo Bightman. Pelkey says he had very personal reasons for working on this issue.
One of my earliest childhood memories was my, you know, waking up in the middle of the night, I think it was 3 years old, and seeing my father, who's my size, 6'4" tall, and my mother in, you know, with his hands around her throat. She was a little tiny refugee from Yugoslavia. And when he saw me come stumbling out of the living room, he dropped her on the floor, and that's what I remember. I think one of the key issues that I focused on was the fact that strangulation of a household member was not classified as a violent felony under Wyoming law. Strangulation of a household member, strangulation of anyone, is one of the most violent acts that you can commit. And I carried that bill on my own in the past, but we got it as an interim topic, and we members of the Judiciary Committee got together and found common ground on it, and I think there was a fairly strong consensus that we should advance that bill out to the floor, and it passed both houses and was signed by the governor this year.
Well, what got me interested right off the bat when I got elected 2 years ago in the House, one of the first meetings I ever got invited to was the Sheridan County Coalition Against Violence and Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And so when I sat in on their meetings, the first few meetings, it was just, it hit me like a hammer. You know, just I had no idea a lot of that stuff was even going on, and that, how bad the situations were, and I was just listening and taking notes on how, what we could do to help these victims get out of these bad situations. And that's what led to my individual bill on the cell phones.
Can you kind of describe what that bill was about?
Right. So in these meetings, I asked the ladies, what can we do? What is the biggest barrier for a lot of these people that want to leave but don't? And the number one issue was control and the, kind of the stalking aspect of it too. And we dug deeper, and it turns out, you know, the cell phone has played a big part in it, because nowadays you can track people's whereabouts on their cell phones. And so if somebody was going to go get help, the abuser could see that and track this person and make things a lot worse. So it really puts people in a bad situation. So what my bill did was it allowed victims to petition the court when they get their protection order to allow the judge to allow them to take responsibility for their cell phone plan and the data that goes along with it to protect them and allow them get that safety net so they can get out.
Yeah. Anything that you remember kind of that helped to bridge any divides or any difficulties that you might have seen mm-hmm. that you had to overcome in terms of making sure that it remained sort of nonpartisan?
Well, I think it, like Charles said, it happened organically. I think, you know, on an issue such as this, it's nonpartisan, it's doing the right thing, and it brings people together, and we just all kind of coalesced around it, because all of us that, you know, really championed this issue really felt strongly about it and passionate about it. So I don't look at Charles and think Democrat. Some people are trained to operate.
He thinks Bernie Sanders.
But you know, it's relationships, it's people, and you know, believe it or not, politicians are human beings too, and we have friendships and we build friendships, and we're able to coexist with each other, even though we could be completely polar opposites on the political spectrum. But
that kind of stuff goes on all the time here. I'll probably leave my Bernie Sanders sticker on the back of my car for a long time just to grate on somebody's nerves. But and to say I told you so.
I'll keep my Ted Cruz sticker.
But you know, it's those things go out the door when we walk through here and go into the chamber. Senator Enzi often said, you know, I think it's the 80% rule. People agree on 80% of things, and mm-hmm. it's just those big ticket hot button items that separate people, and as long as you can keep those discussions civil, I think it'll be fine. So,
yeah. Well, thank you guys both so much.
Thank you.
Take care.
That was State Representative Charles Pelkey and Senator Bo Beitman speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards for our series, I Respectfully Disagree. Congress just kicked off its new session, and now Democrats control the House, which will change the role Wyoming's delegation will be playing in Washington. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from the nation's capital.
While many pundits are predicting pure gridlock for the next 2 years, Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi senses an opening to completely revamp how Washington spends money. He's the chair of the Budget Committee, and he's using that perch to call for overhauling the way both parties dole out cash and blow up the federal debt and deficit, including Republicans, over the last 2 years. That's why Enzi wants to start by changing from an annual to a two-year budget process like they have in Cheyenne.
We have too much money to consider trillions of dollars in 1 year. So we need to spread it over 2 years. Then the agencies would also know in advance what they're going to have to spend. They can plan for 2 years instead of just 1 year.
Enzi is also taking aim at the naming conventions they use at the Capitol that he says are used to hide how money has moved around and even hidden in plain sight. See, Enzi chairs the Budget Committee, but he isn't in charge of any federal spending. That's handled by the Appropriations Committee. He says the names themselves need updating.
In every one of the state legislatures, that would be called the Budget Committee. In Wyoming, it's the Budget Committee. Now, what my job is to set limits for the spending. And that's in categories, not specifically. And so I think that the committee that I chair should be the Debt Limit Control Committee.
During the 2016 election, Enzi held 13 hearings exploring sweeping and even some small changes to the budget process. He had hoped to get them enacted before voters cast ballots for either Trump or Hillary Clinton in order to take the politics out of it. But the effort was derailed, and Enzi sees an opening to revive it this year.
So I think we can start where we left off and get that done. And once again, nobody knows in 2 years who the president's going to be or who Congress is going to be. So at the very worst, what we'll have to do is make the budget reform go into effect after the next election.
If Wyoming's junior senator, John Barrasso, has his way, some of that money will go to an expansive infrastructure bill. He chairs the Environment and Public Works Committee. Last year, his committee was able to strike a broad bipartisan compromise on a water infrastructure bill that passed the Senate by a vote of 99-1 before Trump signed it into law. As the tram under the Capitol pulled up, Barrasso explained how he wants to use that model to fund roads, bridges, and the like.
And then, of course, we're going to have to work with the administration as well as the House. And the House is under new leadership, but I think there's a, in terms of what we can do in a bipartisan way, we've proven it the last Congress that we can do that in a bipartisan way, and the goal is to do it again.
Then there's the environment portfolio under Barrasso's control. Just before Christmas, he penned an op-ed in the New York Times laying out his vision for addressing carbon pollution, which he says doesn't need to include a tax, as many Democrats and even some Republicans have called for. He says besides nuclear power, innovating how we use dirty fossil fuels is the way to avert the potential environmental catastrophes that scientists predict will stem from climate change. Barrasso maintains that he's been working on this since he's been in Washington.
When I was early in the Senate, my career, we put out legislation on establishing prizes for carbon capture, ways to deal with utilization, make carbon profitable, carbon sequestration, and so that's been 10 years ago. So this is continuing to build on that goal that I've had from the beginning.
But House Democrats say they plan to tackle climate change head on.
We're going to move aggressively.
That's New Jersey Democrat Frank Pallone, the new chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. He's with Barrasso on pushing for an expansive infrastructure bill, but the two are destined to butt heads because Pallone and other Democrats want that bill to address climate change without skirting the issue.
You know, certainly there are a lot of things that can be done as part of an infrastructure bill. That's a priority of the House, is to move infrastructure bill, and for us too. So that's certainly an opportunity to put some things in.
But we'll probably do a lot of different things.
As for Wyoming's sole House member, Congresswoman Liz Cheney starts this new year in a new position. She's now the number 3 House Republican, a role that puts her in charge of messaging for the party. And Cheney is vowing that her party isn't going to just lie down and roll over, even if they're now locked in the minority in the House.
We need to get on offense. And I think especially because we're in the minority now, we've got to be in a position where we're making sure that we're out there every day fighting. And I think we've got to be sure we're winning the news cycle. I think that we've got to have a much more sort of an aggressive approach given that we're in the minority.
Cheney says a big part of her job is going to be merely coaching her fellow Republicans to highlight the progressive agenda being pushed by Democrats. But Democrats are still flying high after making historic gains in the House in November. And they're itching for the battles to come, especially because the next presidential election seems to be hanging over everything that happens in Washington these days. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When we come back, we begin a series on skiing. This is Open Spaces. You are listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Today, we begin a series with our Mountain West Bureau about the ski industry and its importance to our region's economy. There's no doubt it can be a very expensive sport, and there's a concern that mergers and acquisitions could make it even more pricey. So is it increasingly a sport for the wealthy? Well, we visited a couple of very different places, such as Bogus Basin in Idaho. But first, Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska checked out the Jackson Hole Mountain Resort.
The mountain draws visitors from all over the world. Lift tickets here average $140 a day, and staying at the village can cost anywhere from $300 to $2,000 a night. The village is pretty glitzy with boutique shops and upscale restaurants, but ask Jackson Hole's Anna Cole, and she'll tell you the mountain has built its reputation on serious skiing.
This mountain is unlike any others you'll ever experience.
Lots of steep and deep runs, she says. I decide to give it a try. Trey Sharp is my guide. As we ride up the Bridger Gondola, he tells me he grew up in Jackson Hole. This mountain isn't for the faint of heart.
You have exposed cliff bands, and you have some danger. It instills a bit more of the sense of adventure, or it keeps it fresh instead of someplace that's completely pampered.
Sharp takes me on the aerial tramway. We go up 4,000 vertical feet.
If you are considering going into the backcountry, please have all of your proper equipment, knowledge, partner, gear, plan. And if you don't know, don't go.
Sharp leads me to the legendary Corbett's Couloir shoot run.
It's like dropping into, say, a half pipe. You know, it's vertical at the top and one very committing turn.
My stomach flips. Thankfully, it's closed, and we ski down another less scary black diamond. At the base, we head to a popular restaurant for an après-ski. We both opt for a $19 twisted Reuben.
And you know that's made with salmon, right?
You do.
Perfect. I double-check. Some people miss that.
This is a feeling Jackson Hole says it wants you to have. Feeling accomplished after a full day of skiing and then on to enjoy the village with friends. I'm Camila Kadalska in Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
And I'm James Dawson in Bogus Basin, Idaho.
1, 2, 3. Ah! I'm freaking out!
No village, fancy restaurants, or five-star hotels here. Most families drive in for the day. 8-year-old twins Scarlett and Vivian have been skiing at Bogus since they were toddlers.
I love all the jumps, the ends, there's in the secret caves and the passages.
The ski area is one of just a handful of nonprofits in the country. Its operating budget is about $8.3 million, and they get about 340,000 visitors in the winter, mostly locals. Scarlett and Vivian's parents had their first date there.
He was like the classic hot guy out of the 90s.
That classic hot guy here is Pat, and he's been skiing at Bogus since he was 6.
I remember driving up the road in the back of the station wagon, my mom driving and having to listen to my sister's music.
You know, the classics like Madonna, The Cure, maybe throwing a little Scorpions. He skied a lot of places, but the vibe there keeps him going back.
All my friends that I grew up with in the 80s and 90s that when we grew up skiing together, we now have our kids, and our kids are getting up there. There's just such a tradition of the love of skiing.
Suzanne says she loves the Bogus vibe too, but the vibes at swanky resorts like Aspen, not so much.
Get out of the car and you're like, everybody's got mascara and the fancy outfit. And the thing about Bogus is like the most beautiful, you know, stylish women here will just be like, I woke up and put my beanie on and we're going to go have some fun. And I love that.
The next day, I meet the family at Bogus for lunch, sandwiches and fries served on olive green cafeteria trays. Pat's friend Jesse Weiss is joining us as well. He's been a ski instructor at Bogus and Jackson Hole and says they're completely different.
What they say about Jackson is the locals are better than the pros. So Jackson has a much more serious vibe. Here, it's about being rad and having fun.
And that's part of how Bogus Basin officials try to stand out. A day pass here is less than half the price of Jackson Hole and roughly a third of the price of a day pass at Vail. And the low prices and new summer programs may be working. From 2014 to 2017, attendance has nearly doubled. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm James Dawson.
The ski industry is dealing with some pretty big changes right now. Probably the biggest one is climate. Winters are getting shorter, and mountain resorts are having to adapt. Allie Budner reports.
On a hot day back in September, I visited Arapaho Basin Ski Area, just 80 miles west of Denver.
We got Dad and kiddo over here playing Frisbee.
The resort's Mike Nathan is giving me a tour. As we walk, Nathan points to a couple of kids running through a sprinkler.
I guarantee you that's a first for A-Basin. Kids shirtless playing in water in September at almost 11,000 feet.
Oh, and that German music in the background?
Today's our first ever Oktoberfest here at A-Basin.
Nathan says it's been a summer of firsts for this small ski area.
It's the first summer that we've had true, like, events every weekend.
He says they've drawn more people up this summer for hiking, mountain biking, and wildlife viewing. On the day I visited, the gold-leafed aspens were an attraction, in addition to the Biersteins and Strudel, of course. Nathan says the summer expansion was a natural way of growing their business and bolstering their annual income using infrastructure they already had.
We think we've got such a cool place here that we really want to try to encourage people to use it all year round.
But the move is also related to shrinking winters. A recent report funded by the Environmental Protection Agency said if our current warming trend stays on course, nearly all ski areas in the country will see their winter recreation season shorten by a lot, 50% by 2050 and a whopping 80% by 2090. That's a problem for the ski industry. Tori Udall is with the Boulder-based nonprofit advocacy group Protect Our Winters.
Really, snow equals money, and more of it is more money, and less of it is less money.
According to the Outdoor Industry Association, snow sports contribute over $17 billion and more than 170,000 jobs to the economy. And that's in our region alone. Earlier this year, Udall's group published its own economic report.
During low snowfall years, the average number of jobs lost across the country is over 17,000, and the average revenue loss is just over $1 billion.
Of course, weather and snow seasons can vary quite a bit. In response to a question on preparing for climate change, a representative from Vail Resorts said they're not too worried. They're having a really good snow year. And that's true. Chris Linsmeyer is with Colorado Ski Country USA, an industry group that represents 23 ski areas in Colorado.
This year, we've had plentiful early season snowfall.
But he says it's important to note that over the long term, the mountains have been seeing more frost-free days,
which has a huge impact on our industry, especially in the early season as resorts are utilizing man-made snow and working to get the resorts open. That's certainly a trend that we've seen.
And it's a trend the ski industry can't ignore.
Climate change is certainly something that our resorts are seeing affecting their business and are taking seriously and trying to come up with solutions to it.
Small resorts like Arapahoe Basin and big ones like Aspen.
We actually debuted our newest summer activity center up on Snowmass this summer. It's called Lost Forest.
That's Christian Knapp with the Aspen Skiing Company.
And we've got several cool activities built into the forest up there for families to enjoy. There's an alpine coaster up there. We've got a giant rock climbing wall. And we've really continued to build out our mountain bike downhill program as well.
But he says Aspen is also focusing on how to make and keep more snow on their slopes for the fall, winter, and spring.
We are investing in more snowmaking coverage, pipelines, holding ponds, more brushing on the mountains so you can open with less snow, all those things. We want to be prepared going forward.
Back at Arapahoe Basin, Mike Nathan says they're preparing that way too. And he says while summer offerings aren't a silver bullet, it will definitely help their bottom line.
We've been very pleasantly surprised with the numbers we're getting, but to compare them to our winter visitation is it's apples and oranges, totally.
Their bread and butter, you could say, is still in the powder. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Allie Budner.
Last February, Jackson Hole Mountain Resort launched a new extreme skiing competition. At the award ceremony, the top male won $5,000, more than the top female. Photos of the winners with their checks drew ridicule on social media, and the resort immediately pulled together funds to fill the gap. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson reports, there's nothing that guarantees equal prizes in big mountain skiing.
At the count of one, Kate Zeliff soared off a snowy cliff. She pulled a shifty, kicking the tails of her skis to the left and straightening them again as she dropped what looks like 20 feet into Corbett's Couloir. Flanked by rock walls on either side, she stuck the landing, took some graceful turns, and launched off a jump into a spread eagle before cruising across the finish line. For that stellar run, Zeliff was crowned Queen of Corbett's Couloir and handed a check.
I was so blown away by what that meant for my skiing and what that meant for me and potentially my career and all these other things that I didn't even look at what my check said.
But other people noticed that her check said $3,000, while the king of Corbett's held a check for $8,000. An Instagram post with images of the checks called out Jackson Hole for perpetuating the gender wage gap. Zeliff says by the next day, Jackson Hole had fixed the disparity, but that wasn't the end of the discussion.
What was interesting was the next day when I was getting phone calls and texts and emails like, aren't you pissed? I was like, whoa, I didn't even think about it, to be honest with you.
As a 24-year-old skier just entering her pro career, she was excited to be winning any money at all. But she admits paying attention to these issues is what leads to change. Tom Winter agrees.
It's good to see people having these conversations because obviously awareness that things could be done better, that awareness, once you have it, starts helping you look for solutions.
Winter is the America's manager for the Free Ride World Tour. At the annual series of competitions, the best free skiers in the world vie for the world champion title. But to get on the world tour, a skier must qualify. And Winter says at the qualifying competitions, the prizes aren't always equal.
Usually when you have events that are fueled with entry fees, that impacts prize purse funds on offer for athletes.
In other words, the more athletes in a given category, the more money they're competing to win. Winter says that puts women at a disadvantage because fewer of them compete.
We need to start asking questions of event organizers about parity and about participation.
Winter says the International Free Skiers and Snowboarders Association sets guidelines for competitions, but resorts aren't required to provide equal prizes. But if they did, Winter says, it would entice more women to pursue competitive big mountain free skiing. He points out women can't be expected to achieve the same degree of athleticism or take the same risks as men if they don't have access to the same resources. And there are resorts who've figured out how to make sure they do. Grand Targhee in Wyoming is one of them. So is Crystal Mountain in Washington State, where Brianna Stoutenberg is the events coordinator.
You know, the men and the women, they're skiing the same terrain. So that's really important to me as an event coordinator that we do provide the same payout to the men and the women.
I asked Stoutenberg about Tom Winter's point that when fewer women compete, there's less prize money to go around. She overcomes that by pulling the entry fees from the men and the women together. Then she divides accordingly to provide cash prizes to the top female and male finishers. Men might get less with this equation, but Stoutenberg hasn't heard complaints.
It seems to have worked for our resort and our athletes for the past 5 years or so.
I also reached out to Crested Butte Mountain Resort and Taos Ski Valley, but I couldn't get a clear answer on how they handled prizes at the free skiing qualifiers they host. Winter says consumers can help promote good practices by supporting the resorts and event sponsors who do the right thing.
I think that consumers should be activists. I think they should be engaged. That's how change happens.
Kate Zeliff, the 2018 Queen of Corbett's, says change is happening fast. She just competed in a free ride world tour qualifier at Revelstoke in British Columbia. She texted me to tell me how it went. The message said, got third place and the prize money is equal, exclamation point. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
When we come back, we'll talk to a pair of Wyoming mystery riders. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. The population in Tai Siding, Wyoming is technically zero. It's basically just a post office that serves homes and ranches in this part of southeast Wyoming. But though the population is tiny, there are not one but two popular mystery riders living there, and they're married to each other.
I'm Tasha Alexander.
And I'm Andrew Grant.
And you're both authors.
We are.
Yeah. We have so few other transferable skills that this is what we've ended up doing.
That's
for a living.
Right. Plus, it allows us to stay home and work in our pajamas.
Tasha is the author of the Lady Emily mystery series, and Andrew has written several crime series, including a new one whose first installment is out this week. I spoke with them at their home near Tai Siding. It's down a long dirt road and up into the foothills of the Rockies. The house is heated by a crackling fireplace. a perfect spot to sit down and have them reveal to me the mystery of how, after years in Chicago, they ended up in this remote corner of the state.
When I was a senior in college, I was dating a boy, and I followed that boy to Laramie after we graduated. He did a master's at UW, and I grew up in northern Indiana. I had never seen a mountain. I'd always been really fascinated by the pioneers and westward expansion, so coming out and seeing the prairie and then the mountains, within a day of arriving, I just knew it was going to kill me to ever leave. But I did have to leave because after the master's, there was a PhD, and we moved around a lot. But I always wanted to come back here.
And for me, it's a very strange thing to be living here because I was born and I grew up in England, and people sometimes say, well, could you ever imagine yourself living somewhere like this? And the answer has to be no, because there is nowhere like this in England. So it wasn't even conceivable that I would imagine it because I didn't know it existed. I had a brief career in theater, then telecommunications. During that time, I decided I wanted to become a writer. So when my first book was written, but hadn't actually hit the shelves yet, it was time for me to start coming to book conferences and start meeting people and getting some exposure. So I came over to the States to a big crime fiction conference called BoucherCon, and I walked into the bar on the first night of the conference, met Tasha, and that was it.
I lured him to Wyoming. But actually, the way Wyoming came into it is I have a son, and I wanted both Andrew and my son to see Wyoming kind of before Alexander, my son, went off to college. So we did I planned a road trip, and I wanted to spend time in Laramie because that's where I came into my own as an adult. And I was so happy to be back in Wyoming. I got out of the car and I took all these pictures and I said to him, do you want to get out? He's like, I'm good. But we get to Laramie. We had not been here 24 hours. And he turned to me and he said, could we live here? It was a pretty short journey from him saying, could we live here? To me saying, okay, so I have three places. And I said, okay, so somewhere around Centennial, Woods Landing, or Tie Siding. We found the listing for this house. I mean, it was just as if it was meant to be.
Tell me what sort of an average day of working looks like out here.
I like to get up and immediately get started working. So I usually get up, make a pot of tea, and just go straight up to my office. And my goal is to start working before I can find something else that will distract me from that.
Yeah, I'm a little different because for me, if I feel like there are boring jobs hanging over me, that distracts me and I feel like I've got to get them out of the way. So what I do is I'll do email for half an hour. Then I've got a little gym set up in the garage, so I'll go and exercise for an hour or so. Then shower and start work. And then I'll work I can constructively work for maybe 6 hours.
This is because he's much more responsible than I am. I think, great, I have to write. No email, no washing the dishes. I can put all that aside. Because it's the easiest thing in the world to find reasons to not write.
What's it like being married to another writer?
Well, it's fabulous and I highly recommend it. I think one of the things that's great about it is that we both understand the industry. On the one hand, you're engaged in this really creative thing. Your work is so deeply personal, but at the same time, it's a business. So it's good to have someone who understands that from the inside, and also who understands the stages of writing a novel. Because, you know, there are times when you really just, like for me, if I'm percolating an idea, I cook. It lets my mind kind of wander a little bit if you're kind of just partly engaged, you know, and that's when you get the really good ideas. And he knows that that counts as work.
One thing that I find really interesting about the two of you is, Tasha, you have your Lady Emily mysteries, and Andrew, you have several different series, and the Lady Emily mysteries are set in London, and so many of your different series are set in the United States. How do each of you influence each other in some of those settings and with some of those characters, maybe coming from places and cultures you didn't necessarily grow up in?
Yeah, well, you know, I was an Anglophile from the time I was very, very young, from the time I first read Pride and Prejudice, when I was too young to really understand it, but I really loved Mr. Darcy, as we all do when we read Pride and Prejudice. So now I have my own Mr. Darcy who can check my Briticisms versus Americanisms, because with the best will in the world, I mean, I am American, so I'm sometimes going to get things wrong. But it is kind of ironic that he writes about Americans and I write about Brits.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, it's the opposite of being an Anglophile. You know, growing up in England, every good movie, every TV show you watch, everything cool, everything you aspire to, it's all coming from the States. So, you know, growing up, that's really where my focus was. And when I had the opportunity to move here, it was fantastic. So my first book, I wanted to set it in the United States. And I didn't really feel like I could write an American character at that point. So I thought, well, I'll have it that the character's English, but he's in the States, which in some ways was interesting because you can have a kind of outsider's perspective a little bit. But also I thought to myself, you know, I know enough. I've seen enough TV shows and movies and things to know the difference between English English and American English. But boy, was I wrong. And so having somebody that I can say, you know, my copy editor's objected to this. I mean, surely this is obvious. And also,
we would never call Tylenol paracetamol.
Yeah, you know, there are just these little things. And another thing that I had to really adjust to is the fact that American English is often grammatically much more correct than English English. So I was full of all kinds of bad habits for my verbs not agreeing with my nouns and whatever. And it was a real, you know, it really pulled me up sharp having to write to this new standard.
Something that I find sort of surprising, maybe to people who wouldn't think of it or live in Wyoming, is that we have several mystery writers living sort of out there here in the state. So we have the two of you, we have CJ Box, we have Craig Johnson. Is there something about Wyoming that attracts mystery writers, do you think?
Well, and we have Lee Child too.
And Lee Child is the author of the Jack Reacher series.
Either you're from here, and if you're from here, you've just got that wonderful Wyoming brain from the beginning where you can think and you've got space and freedom to just think and do your thing. But like for us and for Lee, moving out here, it's just a wonderful place to work.
It is. It's absolutely amazing, you know, that lack of the escape from the feeling of being boxed in and trapped. You know, just it just frees you. It kind of gives you more mental bandwidth. And I've just never felt as productive or as creative as I have since we've moved here.
Tasha Alexander and Andrew Grant are authors living here in Wyoming, and both have new books available now, Uneasy Lies, The Crown, and Invisible. Thank you both so much.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
The Murray family played an important role in preserving wild places in the Jackson Valley and all around the U.S. When StoryCorps came to Jackson this summer, friends Nancy Leon and Jean Jorgensen remember Marty Murray and the contributions her family made to conservation.
As I walked out the door to come to do this, my husband Pete, who knew them better than I, said to me, "Tell them that quote that Marty said to me in 1957, enough is enough," meaning the impact of humans on the precious environment was already evident to her that long ago, and that she was very concerned about what happens to habitats when there is too much human impact.
And I will say, I like to think of the Murrays as the John Muir of Alaska and Wyoming and another part of our very important history of conservation in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so they were basically sort of the founding members of looking at an ecosystem not as the study of one species, but as an entire ecosystem of all the animals and the flora and the fauna all together and how they cooperate. And some of their science actually was the reason that Grand Teton National Park was expanded from the original just the core peaks into including quite a bit of the valley of Jackson Hole.
And thank you very much for covering that, because I think there are relatively few people these days who come to the valley and stay who really understand that kind of history and the scope of how important some people have been in preserving that.
What makes them relevant today, and again, why I really feel this story is so important to share with others, is that they were very humble people, and they worked together initially with colleagues to form the Wilderness Society, which still exists today. And they then were able to convince Congress and President Johnson back in 1964 to set aside millions and millions of acres across the entire United States to preserve that land for perpetuity in wilderness. And they actually did that, you know, kind of one person or several people at a time. And so for me, one of the lessons that comes out of this, too, is to believe that even today, as complex as the world has become, that the power of one, the efforts that one person can make in a collaborative effort, in a quiet effort, you can accomplish, you know, a lot of things according to your values.
Friends Nancy Leon and Jean Jorgensen talking at StoryCorps in Jackson. Alex Schaefer produced this piece. Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you missed part of our program or would like to hear it again, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. There, you can find all of our features and past programs.
You can also sign up for our podcast there or wherever you get your podcasts. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We also invite you to get news stories from our Wyoming Public Radio and Media Facebook page, and you can find all of our reporters on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.